Hello, friends, and welcome to Through These Doors, a Fame Recording Studios podcast. I'm your host, Rodney Hall, with Fame Recording Studios, where it all started in Muscle Shoals. And together, we'll be digging deep into the history of Fame Recording Studios and the Muscle Shoals sound, with the musicians, engineers, producers, and music insiders that have turned this small town into a music landmark known around the world. Welcome. Let's get it on. All right. Welcome to the next episode of Through These Doors, a Fame Studios podcast. Today, we are very lucky to have a legendary artist from the early days of Muscle Shoals music, Mr. Tommy Rowe, with us. How you doing, Tommy?
I'm doing great, Rodney. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. Great to have you. So Tommy is from Atlanta, Georgia. His career spans multiple decades, where he's earned 23 top 100 singles, six Billboard top 200 albums, four gold singles, including Sheila, Dizzy, Sweet Pea, Jam Up, and Jelly Tight, has appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show, toured with the Beatles, Roy Orbison, Sam Cooke, Jerry Lee Lewis. He is a member of the Georgia Music Hall of Fame, the Rockabilly Hall of Fame, Hit Parade Hall of Fame, and the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So that one kind of caught me off guard. I was wondering how you got in the Iowa.
I have a bunch of fans in Iowa, and I worked up there from the beginning of my career, just constantly.
Right.
So I developed a really good fan base from there in the Midwest, and I didn't even know they had a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but
right. You know,
I'm always thrilled to receive these kind of awards and recognition, you know. So the next one will be the Alabama Hall of Fame.
Yes, sir. You deserve it. I don't know if you know this or not. And doing my research, you know, you had the first song that was recorded at Fame on Avalon Avenue, where we are now, was Jimmy Hughes' Steal Away.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not the first hit. Everybody was the first hit.
Right. Yeah, I knew that.
Because Steal Away didn't come out until 65, I believe, or 64. And
right.
I think Everybody was in 63. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, so you had the first hit out of Fame Studios on our current location, and you had, I think you had three of the first four or five. Joe Tex had a hit during that time, and Jimmy Hughes had a couple, and you and the Tams, of course.
That's correct, yeah. The Tams ended up recording there. They were managed by the St. Bill Lowry, the same manager out of Atlanta. And after I recorded there, they brought the Tams in there, and they did most of their early recordings there at Fame Studios, and most of the hits were cut there.
Right. I know What Kind of Fool Do You Think I Am,
right,
and Laughing Off, and some of those early records. But, yeah, you know, Bill Lowry is such an important piece to the Muscle Shoals history. He kind of gets left out. Everybody talks about Jerry Wexler and Atlantic Records, but without Bill Lowry and bringing you and the Tams and Joe South and Ray Stevens and Jerry Reed over, you know, it may have never happened, may have never gotten off the ground. He was just a huge, huge part of that whole scene. And, you know, I don't think he gets the credit he deserves.
Well, he loved working with Rick. I know when I recorded there, we always had, it was like a party. I mean, it was so much fun recording there. I recorded Sheila in Nashville, and that was my first hit. I recorded that at the RCA Studio B, which is now a museum, I think.
Right.
And so we wanted to change our location after that. I had a follow-up, Susie Darling. It didn't do too much. So Bill said, I'm taking you to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. I said, Muscle Shoals, Alabama? What's over there? He says, I've got a friend over there that's got a studio, and he's eager to record you. So that's how that all happened. And, you know, it was amazing when I got there. Rick was so receptive. And so, I mean, he just poured his whole talent into doing my session, you know, and everything just fell into place. All the musicians, you know, Norbert Putnam and Jerry Carrigan on drums, and you know, the whole crew there, they were terrific. Yeah.
David Briggs, I think.
And, yeah, David Briggs.
And was Terry Thompson still around?
Terry Thompson on guitar. And I actually brought my guitarist over there as well, Bobby West, who played the lead guitar on Carol, which we recorded there. And he was my guitar player in my original band called the Satins in Atlanta.
Right. Right. So did you grow up in a musical family, Tommy? Did you?
Yeah.
How did you get into music?
I did. My mom played, you've heard this story so many times, played organ in the church, you know, and she took us every Sunday to church with her little tie on suits. And so that's kind of how I grew up, you know, listening to music in the church. And then, of course, my dad played guitar, and he's the one that taught me how to play the guitar. And that all kind of fell into place when I was about 14 years old. I had this knack for writing these little poems, and I wrote this poem for a girl I was going to school with. Her name was Frida. It was called Sweet Little Frida, You'll Know If You See Her Blue Eyes in a Ponytail. And so that poem eventually turned into the first hit I had, Sheila. We changed the title from Frida to Sheila.
Right.
And that's how it all started.
And Judd Phillips was involved in that record, right?
He was. Judd, the brother of Sam Phillips out of Memphis,
right?
He released my high school version of Sheila, which was it was completely different kind of record. It was just 2/4 drums, and we didn't have the triplet drums in it, you know, like we did on the hit version. But it got a lot of airplay around the Southeast, and I think that's one reason that when we released the second version of it, people remembered the first version. DJs remembered the first version, and they gave it a shot, you know. And I know Buddy Dean was the one that really broke the record up in Baltimore. He was Save Your Kisses was the A side, and Sheila was actually the B side of the record. And he flipped it over and played Sheila. And as we say, like in the old days, we'd say the phones lit up, you know, people started requesting Sheila, and that's it. It took off out of Baltimore and became a number one record.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. So Judd was kind of your intro into the music business. Is that correct?
Yeah. He's the one that suggested we change the title. He said, you know, I love this song Freedom, but I'm not crazy about the title. He says, we got to come up with a different title. So that was his idea.
Right. So it became Sheila.
Yeah.
So you did some touring, I guess, early on with Sam Cooke. Is that right?
That was my first big tour after Sheila. I was a real greenhorn. I mean, I'd never performed professionally before, just locally around Atlanta, fraternity parties and opening record stores, wherever they'd let us play, you know. But when Sheila became a hit, all of a sudden I was thrown in with all these professionals that I had admired so much listening to on the radio, you know.
Right.
And so the first big tour I did was with Sam Cooke, and on that tour was Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Jerry Butler and the, what was his group? Jerry Butler and the, I forgot the name of his group. Yeah. But it was an all-black tour. And I was on the tour with Chris Montez. And that's how I met Chris, was on that tour. And so we toured all through the Southeast in 1962. And then after that tour, I did a few other tours with some other artists. And then Chris and I were booked in England on our tour over there, which we were headlining our first tour in England. And that's how the agent took Chris and I out off of the Sam Cooke tour and booked us over there.
So was that the Chitlin' Circuit you were?
Yeah. We did we'd do auditoriums. They were auditoriums that we would do. And Sam Cooke was incredible entertainer. I don't know if you've ever seen any videos.
Oh, yeah.
But he was an incredible entertainer. And that was a real learning experience for me, because that really helped me with what I ended up doing with my performance, you know, because like I said, I didn't know a whole lot about performing. And so after I finished that tour, I was kind of educated by all the acts on that tour, how they performed and how they handled themselves on stage. So it helped me tremendously.
Yeah, That's, you know, that whole Chitlin Circuit story is a story that I don't think has been told that needs to be told. I had Candy Staten on here a few weeks ago, and she was talking about that. She did a lot of touring during that time with Sam and Lou Rawls, and Aretha was involved, and Mavis Staples. And so, yeah, that's a really interesting story that I don't think has really been.
Yeah, that's where a lot of the acts learn their craft, you know, because, you know, you could do that tour, and by the time you finish that, man, you knew how to deal with an audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had Sheila and I guess at that point you had hooked up with Bill Lowry.
Yeah.
Atlanta, and he says, let's go to Muscle Shoals. And you had no idea what Muscle Shoals was, I'm sure, because it was nothing. Tell me about your experience in Muscle Shoals and what the area was like around Fame at that time, when you came over,
the studio just kind of set out in the open, like in the field, you know, I was nothing much around it.
Right.
It looked very, I mean, it didn't look like a studio. It just looked like a house like a building with cinder block building that somebody vacated, you know, abandoned.
Exactly.
Or
exactly.
And then when you walk inside, it had egg cartons on the walls for sound barriers instead of what we use today, the foam, but he had the egg cartons. And then I found out the echo chamber was a septic tank underneath the building.
Right.
So it was quite an experience after working in Nashville at RCA and all of those studios up there. But I tell you, it just fell in. You know, Rick was a genius. He's the only guy. When we left that studio, we had our records mixed, and we recorded to quarter inch tape. There was no two track.
Right.
It all went to quarter inch. That's why everybody is a Monaural record. You can't find a stereo version of everybody.
Right.
And so we would run the song down, and then we would record it 20 or 30 times just over and over until Rick said, okay, that's the one. Because what he was doing all the mixing and sound, putting the sound elements in the record as we ran it down, as we recorded.
Right.
There was after we finished, we had our record, you know, under our
engineering in that time was a different thing. I tell our guys all the time now, they have computers and undo.
Yeah, right.
Stuff like, you're not an engineer.
Yeah.
You're a computer operator.
Yeah, you're a technician.
back in the day, the engineer had his job was as or more important than everyone else's, because if he didn't get the part right, then the whole take was just out the window, and you had to start over.
That's so true. And Rick's talent was not only engineering, but he was also a fantastic musician and songwriter. So, I mean, he understood all aspects of the session and of working in the studio. So his contribution was really something else.
Yeah. So at Lowry's, so were you signed, I guess, to Lowry Publishing or?
Yeah, I signed to originally Sheila was under Lowry Music, and then, you know, Felton Jarvis was my producer at the time, and Felton started a publishing company with Bill called Lotwy. And then Felton wanted to move to Nashville, and he wanted to sell his share of Lotwy. So Bill let me purchase that share. So I ended up owning half of the publishing company, Lotwy Music. And so that's how I got into again, that's something else I knew nothing about. And fortunately, I was just handled by honest people. I mean, you know, people that really cared about me as a person, not just as, you know, some act that they were using to make money off of.
Right.
And I ended up with half the publishing on all of my songs.
That's incredible. For that time period,
that didn't happen back then, you know.
It really didn't.
Yeah. But Bill treated me like his son, you know. I always felt he was like my second father because we were together so much. I was only 20 years old, you know, so I was actually, I was 20 years going on 16. I was like a young 20 years old. And so Bill really took me under his under his wing and treated me like his part of his family.
Yeah. My dad was just he loved Bill Lowry and felt like it, without Bill that he may have not ever had a music business career.
Yeah.
I know that he was very fond of him all the way his entire life.
Yeah.
So Bill had a whole stable of amazing talent. He had Ray Stevens, Joe South, Jerry Reed, Mac Davis.
Yeah.
Did he work with Atlanta Rhythm Section?
Oh, that was his group, yeah. Awesome. Buddy Bowie and Bill, they managed the Atlanta Rhythm Section.
Yeah. So did you have much interaction with Mac Davis, who was also very instrumental in Muscle Shoals?
Yeah, well, Mac actually wrote for my publishing company in the beginning of his career. I recorded one of his songs. It didn't do anything. It's called Be a Good Little Girl. And right. We recorded that at Fame, actually. It was recorded at Fame. And then I moved to California, and then Mac came after me to California, and he was a record promotion guy. He was promoting records for other artists, and then he was really pursuing his songwriting, and he got his songwriting really up to par, and he decided he wanted to sign with a company out, I think it was Metric Music, out in Los Angeles. And so Bill and I let him go so he could sign with them. And that's when he started writing for Elvis, you know, Elvis publishes all of his songs that Elvis recorded. That was part of Tom Parker's deal. You know, if Elvis did your song, then they would publish it, you know,
piece of it. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, his songwriting, he took his songwriting to another level. And again, thanks to Bill, you know, Bill kind of helped him in the beginning, really taught him how to write songs, you know.
Right.
And he went on to do very well.
Yeah. So my dad, he had a hit on Jimmy Hughes and VJ, the label, had invited him out to L.A. And he gets to L.A. and this guy picks him up, who's his limo, who's going to drive him around all week, and ends up being Mac Davis, who's doing promotion for them. And that's kind of how they became. Yeah.
Jimmy recorded one of my songs. It's one of my favorites, called You Might As Well Forget Him.
Oh, yeah.
And that song went on to be recorded by tons of reggae artists during the reggae, music explosion.
Right. I mean,
it's been recorded by so many different people, but Jimmy's version of it is my favorite version.
Yeah.
I mean, he just really did a bang up job on that song.
Yeah, he could sing. He just kind of, you know, got tired of it after a couple albums and just hung it up. Still, he's still in Muscle Shoals.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, he is. Hasn't sung in.
Well, tell him how much I appreciate his version of my song. You might as well forget him. Because he just does a fantastic job of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you meet Felton Jarvis? Was that through Bill?
Well, that's how, that's when I was with Judd Records. Mm-hmm. There was a DJ in Atlanta named Paul Drew. And Paul used to do these, what we call sock hops back in those days, where they'd play records and the kids would dance. And then he'd usually have a band also to perform maybe a 30-minute set or something. So he had invited my Tommy Rowe and the Satins to perform at his sock hop one Saturday night. And he brought Felton with him to the show. And that's when I first met Felton, was at that Paul Drew show. And Felton started talking to me about recording me, but he didn't want to record the band. He just wanted to record me. And I said, man, I don't know about that, you know, but my bandmates are friends of mine from high school, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But eventually he talked me into it. And boy, we had such brouhaha over that with my bandmates. They got really upset with me.
Sure, yeah.
Not taking them to Nashville to do the recording. And I said, Felton, you got to straighten this out. So he got in touch with him, says, look, we want to do this. And then once we get this done, we'll get back with the band. We'll make everything work out fine. That's why when I recorded in Fame the first time, I took Bobby, my lead guitarist, over with me, because I was trying to heal those wounds, you know?
Right, right. That happened.
But anyway, that's what happened. And I ended up going on my own. And You know, we cut Sheila. That was an interesting time too, because back in those days, the producers, because of the money being so tight, you'd have a 3-hour session and they'd do what they call split sessions. They'd record two artists, and one artist would do two songs and the other artist would do two songs. And so that's what we did with when I cut Sheila. We had a split session with a singer named Marvin Benefield, who sounded just like Elvis. This was before Elvis impersonators. He just sounded like Elvis, you know. So Felton he loved Elvis and he loved Buddy Holly. So he took a singer that sounds like Elvis and a singer that sounded like Buddy Holly, and he did a split session on us. The only problem was Marvin Benefield took 2 hours and 45 minutes, and I was only left with 15 minutes to record my two songs. And Save Your Kisses was the A side, so we did that one first in 10 minutes, and we cut Sheila. We ran Sheila down a couple of times and cut it in 5 minutes, and that was the record.
Right.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up, man. That's, I'm telling crazy. You, it's just the way it was worked back in those days.
I've never heard of a split session, but when you said that, it just clicked in my mind. We've got all these master tapes that'll have two different artists on the same tape, and I always wondered why that was, and that's exactly what it was.
That's probably it. Yeah, that's probably it. Well, you know, the money wasn't so prevalent back then for recording. So if you were an independent producer, you were trying to, you know, use your money well. And a lot of producers did that. And, you know, listen, it worked. They got a hit out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you went on and toured the UK around what year was that? Around 60?
That was 63. That was after the Sam Cooke tour. And, our agent in New York booked Chris Montez and I in England as headliners of this tour. And that's when I first met the Beatles. The Beatles were a featured act on our tour. And of course, after I always joked with John, I said, John, you know, our tour is a springboard for your career. I said, what are you going to give us back here? You know, he'd laugh. And, well, we appreciate it, you know.
Absolutely. So when you were touring with them, though, they weren't the Beatles. They were just,
nobody knew who the Beatles were. In fact, when I first met them, I never will forget, they walked in the room and they looked, you know, at that time they looked very different. I mean, you just have to see them to imagine the way we looked and dressed and the way they looked and dressed was totally different.
Right.
So when they walked in the room, I thought they were our backup band. And then they introduced them as the Beatles, that as a featured act on, they were at the bottom of the bill on our tour.
Right.
And first thing happened, John comes over to me and says, hey, it's good to meet you. We're such big fans of you and Chris. And so we're so proud to be on the tour with you. And he said, you know, we've been doing your song Sheila in our show in Hamburg at the Star Club. And I says, oh man, that's great. He said, but you know, I don't think we're playing it right. I said, well, how are you doing it? He grabbed his guitar and started playing the chords. And sure enough, he had the chords backwards. And I said, yeah, you just got the chords, flip the chords, Rand, you got it. You know, you playing the chords backwards. So he said, I said, it didn't sound right when we were playing it over in Star Club, but the people love the song. And there's a crude record version of that out. It's like a bootleg version of Sheila that somebody recorded at the Star Club. And sure enough, you listen to it, the chords are all, they're all over the place.
That's crazy. So you then, the band and ask you to open them, correct? How did that happen?
Yeah, yeah. The same agent that booked us in England booked them on the Ed Sullivan Show. And while we were touring in England, I had developed this relationship with Brian Epstein, and my manager, Bill, and Brian were talking about working a deal out for Brian to manage me in Europe, in England and Europe. So we were negotiating like a management deal with Brian Epstein. So when the Beatles were booked on the Ed Sullivan Show, Brian got in touch with Bill and said, you know, we have, after the Sullivan Show, we're doing a concert in Washington, D.C., and we'd like for Tommy to open for us. And of course, I was happy to do it. And so we took the gig, and I actually brought the famed musicians up. They were my band. I brought David Briggs, Norbert Putnam, Jerry Carrigan, and Tommy on the guitar. And they backed me on my when I opened for the Beatles in Washington, D.C. That was February 11th, 1964. That was about a year after our original tour in England.
Right, right. And how was that? And I've talked to
Well, I had already experienced Beatlemania in England. So, right. You know, I saw the writing on the wall with these guys. And the thing with the Beatles is, you know, I tried to get my label to sign them to ABC Paramount. You know, I'd hyped Felton on them already. I'd told Felton about these four guys that are like four Elvis Presleys, you know. And so when I went back, when I came back to New York after my tour in England, Brian Epstein had given me a little promo pack. Actually, it was just a NIMS record store plastic bag with a photo in it and an album, you know. And he wanted to see if I could get the Beatles signed to ABC Paramount. So when I got into New York, Felton met me at the docks. I took the Queen Elizabeth over. It took 5 days over the Atlantic on the ship. And he met me at the dock with my bags. And we went right to the president's office from the docks with my bags and all the stuff, my guitars and everything I had. And because we're so excited about presenting the Beatles to the president, you know, and he was anxious. Felton said he's waiting to hear it. He wants to hear it. So we go in and they congratulate me on the tour and say, I understand your tour went well and it's good to have you back. And Felton tells us you have an act from England that you'd like for us to consider signing to ABC Records. And I said, yeah, they're called the Beatles. And he says, okay, well, let me see what you got there. So I gave him the album. He dropped it on the turntable, dropped the needle on the record. I think the first cut was Love Me Do. And he played a few bars of it, picked the needle up, said, I tell you what, kid, that's got to be the worst piece of crap I've ever heard in my life. He said, I tell you what, let us be the talent scouts. You go back. We have you a nice room at the Waldorf. Go over there and write us some more hit songs and we'll find the talent. And so Felton and I were just blown away. You know, I didn't know what to think. I thought, and it turns out, you know, when I thought about it, I said, the whole thing about the Beatles and the beginning of their career, if you just heard their music, it wouldn't really, as we say down south, sink your cork. You know, I mean, it was good, but compared to what we were doing, it was not that extraordinary.
Right.
But so after the Sullivan show, I said, you know, the thing with them, you've got to see them. You got to see them do their music because that's what makes it click for them. If you don't see them, there's no magic there, you know, but when you see them singing those songs, then that's the deal. So after the Sullivan show, all of America saw them on television, and then they did the concert in Washington, D.C. And, you know, you look back on it, the rest is history. I mean, it just went on from there.
Yeah. Amazing. So you can debunk a little. There's been a rumor around that over the years that you played the Beatles for Felton and my dad.
I did.
At Fame.
I did.
And what was their response to it? Do you remember?
They thought I was nuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said, you had to see them.
Right.
And I kept telling them, I said, these guys are unbelievable on stage. I mean, the people love them. I mean, they have a magnetism that's incredible. And, but like I said, if you just, I brought the album, I played it. I remember going in Fame and when we did the second session there in 60, I guess it was 64, after the Beatles tour, we cut some songs and I brought the record in there and played it for them. And all the musicians, everybody, they just had a long face on. They didn't register, you know?
Right.
And in fact, I wanted to cover some of the songs. I wanted to cover the song because nobody had heard about the Beatles in America. And I thought, man, I can take these songs and cover them. They're a really good song. And Bill wasn't buying it and Rick didn't like it at all. Finally, they let me cut one of their songs. I Want to Be Your Man. That's the only one they let me cut.
Yeah.
And I did A Taste of Honey too. I'm not sure if that was on the album, but they used to do that in their show.
Right.
We cut that at Muscle Shoals. We cut I Want to Be Your Man. That was on the Everybody album, you know, the album that came after Everybody.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, come on. That was Rick Hall and Dan Penn's song.
Yeah.
And that was a good girl. That was a good follow-up to Everybody. It did very well.
Was Party Girl.
Party Girl, we cut there. That was Buddy Bowie's song.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's interesting. You know, that you never know when you're looking at history, you know.
Well, it's easy when you look back.
Right.
Like I say, you can see what made it happen the way it happened, you know, because not only my label turned them down, VJ actually released some of their records, but they did nothing because they'd never been seen before. They just, you know, hear their music. Like I said, if you just heard the music, it didn't register.
Right. So, yeah, especially early on.
Yeah, early on, their earliest. Now, later on, of course, they took their songwriting to a different level.
Yeah.
You know, I think I like to describe their early music as blueprints for bubblegum, because if you think about it, Love Me Do and Please Please Me, I Want to Hold Your Hand. I mean, what's the difference in that and Oh Sweet Pea, Come On and Dance with Me? I mean, it's all that light bubblegum music, you know?
Right. So, yeah, absolutely. So I just had a text from Norbert Putnam. He said to tell you hello.
Oh, Norbert. I love Norbert.
Yeah.
Great guy, great musician.
He is. He's actually moved back to the Shoals and has been living here for about 10 years now.
Oh, well, good for him.
Yeah.
His bass playing on Everybody was upright bass. And that's the first time I'd ever recorded with an upright bass.
Right.
And it just made it all the difference. It made it rockabilly, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know how he became the bass player, don't you?
No.
He had started a band with his friends, and his dad was the only one that had a bass.
So you're the bass player, whether you like it or not.
Exactly. Well, I got to tell you, my earliest recollection of playing a 45 was Dizzy. My dad would bring us records home, and that record, I still remember the little ABC logo on it, and that was my favorite record. And I was 3 years old, so I was very young.
Wow. Yeah.
But I wore that record out. What a huge record! It had been a minute since you'd had a hit when you had that one, right?
Well, the last big hit I had was Hooray for Hazel, and that was in 66.
Right.
Then I got on this weird tangent out here in Hollywood, this flower power music, and we did two albums that it was that flower thing, music, you know, it's kind of weird. Yeah. I look back on it, and I think, what was I thinking, you know? But anyway, I did two albums like that, and they went nowhere. And so then I said, man, I got to get back in my bubblegum groove. And that's when I hooked up with Steve Barry. So, Steve was very anxious to record me because he liked what I did before, you know, like Sweet Pea and all that. And he wanted to get me back into that genre. So that's when we cut Dizzy. That was the first session I did with Steve, and we recorded Dizzy on that. And another song called Gotta Keep Rolling Along.
Yeah. Very cool. So am I making this up, or did Dizzy have something to do with the Archies, the cartoon, the Archies?
No, it didn't. It was recorded in Asia, Felix the Cat. They used Dizzy in Felix the Cat, the cartoon.
Right.
And that might be what you're thinking about, but it was very big in Asia, Japan and Singapore, all those Asian countries. And it was on TV for years, and they played Dizzy through the whole thing. You know, it was incredible. Yeah. And my friend from Florida, Mike Franklin, he's the one that recorded the tracks. He actually went to Japan and recorded the tracks for the video.
Yeah, that's great. That's
but
great.
Dizzy's been covered by a lot. You know, it was number one in England in the early 90s by Vic Reeves and the Wonder Stuff. They covered it. It went to number one. It's been recorded by just tons of people. The drums have been sampled. It's one of the most sampled drum licks of hip hop music. Sweet Pea drum licks and Dizzy drum licks are in most of the hip hop records. If you listen to them closely, you'll hear, especially Sweet Pea, you'll hear the Sweet Pea drums in the background in a lot of those records.
Right. Do you see any money from that?
Not originally, but they finally caught up with it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here. We've had a lot of samples and a lot of things.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to go after them. Sometimes they.
Yeah.
Mess up.
It's like a needle in a haystack. I mean, it's just so hard to figure out where all that stuff's coming from. And you just have to stay on top of it the best you can.
Especially these days, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, if you had a hit record, you'd have, you know, four or five income streams.
Yeah.
Coming from the label, or you're coming from your publisher or from BMI or ASCAP. Now it's hundreds for songs that aren't even hits. Just,
yeah, you got it right. And
fractions of pennies.
You know, and a lot of the artists are not aware of this, but like they don't sign up for Sound Exchange. They have several organizations now that you really need to be a part of, because they never used to pay artist performance royalties in the States until later on. They did in Europe for even in the 60s, but they never did here. And now you have Sound Exchange where artists get paid for their performance, you know, and musicians as well.
Right.
And that's something we didn't have in the old days. And a lot of my artist friends, they don't even know about it.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, you got to go on the internet, you know, soundexchange.com, and sign up, man, because you're missing on some money.
Yep, absolutely. It's out there for sure. Well, Tommy, it's been great talking to you. I sure appreciate you coming on today. And, you know, it's been an honor. You were so instrumental in getting Muscle Shoals off the ground back in the 60s. And if it's an honor to meet you. I've heard your name my entire life, and really appreciate you being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, Rodney. I'm glad we could do it, and keep rocking, my friend. Rock on.
Absolutely. If you ever get down to Muscle Shoals, please come by and see us.
I would drop by for sure. You know that.
Absolutely. Okay. Great. All right, my friend, have a great week, and I will speak to you soon.
Okay, Rodney. Thanks again, pal.
Thank you.